Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. For most of us, we still remember what life was without the internet, but soon no one will remember life before the internet. What does this inevitably mean? For author Michael Harris, the question is discussed in his riveting book, The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. How have things like silence, wonder, solitude gone out of the window in the age of constant updates, texts, and easily accessible information? Far from another Luddite's manifesto that complains about kids these days, Harris urges us all to reconsider solitude, introspection, and ourselves in the 21st century. Because in a world where teens send 4,000 texts a day and almost everyone on a sidewalk has their head buried in a cell phone, something is definitely gone. Maybe. Not irrevocably. Welcome to our show.
Thank you so much.
You know, your book was amazing. It was wonderful. And more important, it was relevant. Okay.
So I hope so.
I want you to jump in, you know, even with the title of your book, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. The End of Absence. What are you talking about in this book?
Well, you know, it's funny you ask about that because the title really was something that, it was a little bit difficult to come to. We had this argument about the title between me and the editors and the publishers because not everyone knew what does that mean, the end of absence, right? It's a bit confusing. But for me, absence was really this catch-all term for things like solitude and daydreaming and reverie. These qualities of life that digital constant connection tends to wipe away from us. So that's sort of where it came from. It began with this realization that we're the last generation in history to know life before the internet. And that the quality of life that we're going to remember, that future generations won't be able to remember, is that quality of absence, that quality of solitude. So that's what I wanted to try and describe in the book.
So let me ask you a question. Did we ever have a life of absence and solitude, or did we have a life of more introspection and getting to decide what we're going to do in terms of what we're going to read? Because on some level, the internet has made life easier. You know, rather than read three books, we could read 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 articles by experts and save a lot less time.
What I want to hear from you
what is the blessing of the internet and what is the evil of the internet?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I don't actually think that technology itself is good or evil, right? Melvin Kranzberg, who's a philosopher of technology, he said it. He said technology is neither good nor evil, but neither is it neutral, right? And that's what it comes down to, is it's up to us to use these tools. You know, saying that the internet is evil would be like saying that your toaster is evil. It really comes down to how are you going to use it. And I think the evil in our experience of the internet, it's that Marshall McLuhan idea that the technology becomes a lens through which we see the world. So if you're not cognizant of that lens that you've put in front of your eyes, if you're not aware that viewing life through a Twitter feed is altering your perspective on things, that's where you get into trouble. It's when we become ignorant of the history of technology and ignorant of our daily use of technology, when we become complacent in our use of technology, that's where the real evil, I think, shows up.
I mean, I think what you're saying is absolutely true, and yet couldn't that be said about everything? Like, guns are not evil. It's people who use guns the wrong way. Nuclear weapons are not evil. It's people who use them in the wrong way. If it weren't for nuclear weapons, we could have had World War III, but because of the deterrence of a World War III and complete destruction of the Earth, nuclear weapons has saved us. I mean, can we say that about just about anything?
No, absolutely. And, I mean, that brings us to this idea of regulation, right? That just because the onus should be on us as individuals, that doesn't mean that we don't need a little bit of help, right? So, for example, you know, we have this deep desire to connect that's built into us, I think, from a very animal level.
Absolutely.
We want social grooming, right?
We're tribal. We need intimacy. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that desire is in a way being exploited by our technologies and by our technology companies, social networks. So that desire, it requires a certain amount of willpower on the part of a parent or maybe even a government to keep it from running amok, right? I mean, think of the desire we have for sugars and fats, right? Those are built into us because we evolved in an environment where sugars and fats were very rare. Now, where we have a superabundance of sugar and fat, we have to engineer for ourselves healthy food diets. It won't just happen automatically.
Similarly, we're built only for fat. Sugars were not necessarily a part of
our... Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, fructose was what we were built for, but not sucrose. So we're actually engineered for fat, but not for sugar.
Okay. Well, I think the point holds, though, that we in our social lives, we have this deep desire to connect, and now that we have a superabundance of social potential in our lives, we need to engineer absence into it. We can't wait for absence to come automatically, because it doesn't come on its own anymore. Every empty space, every little solitude that we used to experience as a course of natural life now is filled in. The vacuum no longer exists.
But Michael, let me ask you this question. Okay, there are very few people, very, very few, who have the ability to have what's called a blank mind. So regardless of whether or not they're on the internet or they're older people who are not on the internet, their mind is filled with something. So is it the end of absence because we are always self-stimulating with the internet, or is it the end of absence because we don't know how to actually meditate, cut off all the noise in our head, and ask ourselves really very primal questions like, what is my destiny and what the hell am I doing on the earth? Forget about what everyone expects of me.
No, you're absolutely right. This is a long-term problem, right? This is not something that just showed up in the last 20 years. But I would argue that it's a problem that's become exacerbated in the last 20 years. We've got to the point now where absence is really this thing nobody knows how to deal with. We're very uncomfortable when we encounter an empty moment. We just dive into our phone. And I think that discomfort is actually a sign that we need more absence in our lives. And so back to that idea of engineering absence, when you've got the average American teenager now manages 4,000 text messages in a month, right? That's sending and receiving 4,000. That's a maelstrom of connection when really there would have been those tiny moments on the bus or waiting at the bus stop or while they're doing their homework, little moments of daydreaming. And we know that that's where original thought and where thoughts about our own inner self develop, right?
But Michael, let me ask you this question. People who are shy, they now have access to be able to interact with people because of the anonymity, and therefore it reduces the shyness. So now we have people texting all over the place, lying about their age and what they look like and so on and so forth. Don't you think that's creating more fantasy and more of a time when people are just leaning back and thinking about that last email from that hot girl or that hot guy?
I suppose it is. I mean, it definitely encourages a gamification of life, right? I mean, there's been one article I read in Seed magazine that argued the reason we haven't encountered any advanced civilizations from outer space is because at a certain point they get to where we are and they just become enraptured by virtual reality.
I always thought that nobody likes to step in shit, and the aliens are saying, you know what, let me just avoid Earth. but that's my theory, you know. So, but let me ask you a question. What do you think about the fact that now the internet is co-parenting with parents? The fact that the parents are giving kids tools that they don't know effectively how to use because they never knew how to effectively parent. Who's doing a better job, the parents or the internet?
Oh, gosh. Well, I suppose the good parents are doing a better job, and the bad parents are doing no job whatsoever.
They're always doing a job. Trust me. The bad parents are not doing no job. They're always doing a job.
It's a job. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I don't have kids myself. There's a lot of anxiety around children, digital natives, right? And there's a chapter in the book that's called Kids These Days, which is meant as a sort of tongue-in-cheek way of examining that worry that we all have about kids. There's, I believe, the cutoff date is something like 1985. So here's the thing. If you were born after 1985, you've never lived as an adult without the internet, right? You, as a grown person, you only know the world as this kind of cloud-connected digital interface. So I think that there's a very strong wall between those people. And I'm 34 years old. I was born in 1980. So between me and someone even 5 years younger than me, I think there's a massive generational difference. When you ask about parenting, I think what the most important thing we can do for those people who are growing up only knowing life online is to bring some kind of education into high schools and even elementary schools about the history of technology. Because that's, again, that's the most important thing, I think, is to be able to recognize that you are viewing the world through a lens. You are existing in one technological reality that is going to change and has changed before.
But though Michael, there's always been technological advances. I think that the age of the internet has sped that up at a ratio that I cannot even conceive of what that would be. You know, having said that, you know, it's made the world a more dangerous place. And I'm going to take both positions in the sense that one person who has a grudge against you, if he's got a lot of friends, he or she could try to virtually destroy your reputation on the internet. And because people are still not as sophisticated intellectually or emotionally, they still believe what they read, even if what they read is pure propaganda. So the internet has produced the ability to destroy a business or a reputation without recourse.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a bit of an elitist, I guess, when it comes to this, right? I mean, I believe that some opinions are better than others, is what it comes down to. And the internet democratizes opinion in such an extreme way, like you're describing, where there's this kind of celebration of the everyman opinion, right? I think that's what you're getting at.
What I was getting at is that, in fact, it doesn't democratize it. In fact, it puts it in the hands and the elite of those who know how to use the internet. Look at ISIS. Look at an organization, who's basically an organization of thugs, murderers, rapists, who have been given the ability to recruit from all over the world because they are proficient at the internet.
Right. I mean, what I'm saying is, like, if you've got a 12-year-old girl who has no education in literature, she can still go on Amazon and FX the star rating on, say, my book, right?
Right.
So that's what I mean is this kind of crowdsourcing of critical opinion that becomes possible. That idea of the wisdom of the crowds. But I think maybe we're talking about different things there because you're saying it.
But no, Michael, let's back up because you say the wisdom of the crowds. The crowds are always wrong. I mean, history has brought up that crowd or herd mentality, has historically been morally and in most cases scientifically incorrect.
I do not necessarily approve of the process. I much prefer fewer educated opinions, and I think we run the risk, look at the New York Times. This is a sort of dismantling of the old guard and that kind of established communication network. But this is, again, something that happens throughout history, right? The printing press really demolishes earlier monopolies of knowledge. Papyrus did this. The invention of writing, Socrates is very upset about the invention of writing because he thought that would change the way that we think, and in fact it did.
And you're right, because he wasn't able to write. He had the Socratician curses, those people who could think but not write, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So, every step along the way, we've been dealing with this with a kind of barbarians at the gate of public opinion and of knowledge in general, right? Where larger crowds or different crowds are suddenly able to publicize their own opinions. I mean, look at Wikipedia, right? This is where things get really sticky. I'm not worried about random people for a joke going in and changing a Wikipedia page and what that might do. What I'm worried about is the long-term effects over maybe 100 years of corporations or of churches who want to shift the meaning of words or shift the truth about their own institutions. A crowdsourced encyclopedia like Wikipedia, I think, allows for that kind of manipulation over the course of time.
You know what? I agree with that. So the question is that the media technology is here to stay. There's no doubt about it. We cannot put the genie back in the box, and maybe we shouldn't, because in many ways the internet and the technology has allowed medicine, has allowed communication between those who had no voice. So, there's a lot of good applications for it. So do you think there should be an internet police that establishes some rules of what can or could be done so that there's some recourse in some of the areas that are more dangerous?
I think the internet ultimately needs to be regulated, only because if we don't regulate it, if we leave it in the hands of private corporations, what I think is inevitably going to happen is you're going to have the super rich have access to one kind of internet, and the poor will be left behind with another. That could be as simple as having high-speed internet become a luxury item, So imagine if it takes you 20 minutes to send an email and it takes me 10 seconds to send an email, right? So if you don't regulate these things, some things we regulate, like electricity, water, right? Utilities we regulate. And I think the internet has become so, its utility has become so apparent that it is now a utility in the same way that our water and our electricity is. So those things, yes, we have to regulate them. That's not exactly the same thing as a police force, though, right? I mean, the beauty of the internet has been giving voice to those that some authorities would otherwise silence.
Michael, when you say regulation, yeah. There is no such thing as regulation without enforcement.
Of which?
You can't regulate unless you can enforce and penalize, correct?
Right, I see, yeah.
I can't regulate the speed of which a person drives in New York City if I cannot guarantee that the police will give a ticket if they break that speed limit.
Yeah, so, no, absolutely.
So let me ask you this. What do you know about the deep web?
The deep web?
Yes.
You're referring to this idea of like the
web beyond the
web that you get in, where child pornography runs rampant, this sort of thing.
Yeah, you buy and sell weapons and just about anything else.
I mean, that's not really the focus of the book. The book was really about our everyday experience of it. So I wasn't getting into that.
Okay, but do you have a personal opinion about it? Do you feel like that should exist?
Well, I mean, should people be able to buy semi-automatic weapons? No. Should child pornography be available at the click of the button? No, I don't think so.
Let me ask, though, you know what? Because it's funny because you said two different things, and of course, very few people would agree that child pornography should be allowed anywhere, because at the end of the day, you're taking advantage in the most destructive way of a child. Semi-automatic weapons, it all depends on who you talk to. But the question is, should knowledge itself or information itself, is everyone capable of handling information, or is it back to the Tom Cruise movie, you just can't handle the truth?
Right. I mean, this is the sort of dystopian future that we're butting up against, right? The internet promises so much. I don't know if we're going to have to worry about whether or not we can handle all the information. We may need to worry about whether or not the powers that be are screening so much of the information in order to make us into better click monkeys, right? Better data miners.
What you're saying is that they're causing us to move along a path where, along that path, as we move, we're actually providing them with their interests as opposed to our own interests. But who are these powers, by the way? I'm just curious. Who, in your mind, has the power right now to control the flow of information?
Well, every portal that you move through, so any social media network like Twitter or Facebook, certainly, Google, obviously, these are all corporations that make all of their money based on how many times you click on things, right? It's about data mining and then using this to sell advertising to you. So what that means for our daily lives is that they're not interested in what's best for you. They're interested in what you're most likely to click on. So that creates what Eli Parsner has termed a filter bubble, which means whatever you like, I'm going to give you more of what you like. I'm going to create You think when you go on Facebook, you're seeing all of your friends, but you're not. What you're seeing is a filtered version of your social network that an algorithm has decided you are most likely to click on. So now imagine, spread that through Google, spread that through through Google Maps, right? If you search for a pizza joint, what happens if Google Maps decides, oh, Julie doesn't like that kind of pizza joint, so I'm not even going to show her that? You're literally getting, it's called personalization, and it does feel very personal because it's custom built for your likes, but it's also giving you a narrower vision of the world, right? It's giving you a custom built set of goggles that's going to excite you, but we always have to be aware of what is being hidden from us.
Well, isn't it true, though, that anyone and everyone could post, you know, their likes and dislikes, and therefore there is some sort of democratization of the Internet?
Well, consider this. Facebook doesn't let you dislike anything, does it? Because disliking doesn't sell products. So you can only like things on Facebook. For digital natives, we now have... It's become very common for people to post sort of obituaries, you know, my mother died today. And then underneath that, you'll have 22 thumbs ups. What does that mean, really? You've got a digital culture that's so enraptured with self-promotion and retweeting that what is a good thing is that which is popular and viewed by as many eyes as possible, right? And I think being excited and popular are not necessarily the ultimate goals of human life.
So, Michael, tell me, how would you, if you were now the commander-in-chief, the president at large of the Internet, what would you do?
Wow.
What would you do in order to protect the most people which you can? Because when you said before that the Internet doesn't have our own best interest at heart, no one has your own best interest at heart. Sometimes you don't even have your own best interest at heart. Most parents don't necessarily. They have their own interest at heart. Some do, but
yeah,
most don't. So what would you do in order to protect the weak?
Well, I think the most powerful thing we can do is remain open to both worlds, the digital and the analog, and not be subsumed by one or the other. So if I were king of the Internet and I didn't have any financial concerns, I guess what I would hope for everyone would be that we could create a sort of dance between online life and offline life. Again, you know, I'm 34. I'm part of the first generation in history that has more interactions with avatars than with actual people. So this is a kind of a potentially dangerous tipping point, and we may need to engineer those breaks from online life. If you've got a classic American teenager, they're multitasking while they're doing their homework. They're consuming about 10 hours of screen time a day in total when multitasking is taken into account. That's more time than they spend awake and not on the screen. So this tipping point, right, where you need to actually secure a kind of some chunk of the day where you're out just messing around in the woods, as if you're a kid, I think. I guess that's what I would do. I would just—I don't know how to manage that exactly. Maybe you've got a certain amount
life. Here's what I'm going to tell you: the reality is,
yeah,
the way the brain is programmed, the reptilian brain is the oldest part of the brain. That's why it's called the reptilian. It just gravitates towards pleasure and away from pain. The internet was born, literally born, from pornography. If it wasn't for pornography, there wouldn't be the internet. And of course, people watch it because it creates a great degree of pleasure. So the only way that you're going to get people to use the internet less is by creating venues of which there is more pleasure outside of the internet, which is why people play sports and why people get into, you know, different things that are more exciting. You know, back in the 60s, it was sex, drugs, rock and roll. There was no internet, but people weren't sitting back and contemplating unless they were on mushrooms.
Well, the World Wide Web was invented by the U.S. military, not by porn stars.
No. The military invented the internet. Porn stars supported it. You know, the internet was necessary.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was necessary and is necessary, you know, for the communication, you know, weapon systems and so on and so forth. But terms of commercially, back in the early days, it was the pornography sites that became the most commercially viable. And probably to this day, I would think it's the porn sites that get more hits than just about anything else.
No, of course, yeah. I mean, that speaks to that anonymity of the internet, right? We live in still a quite Victorian kind of culture. The things that we're not willing to do in public or not willing to express in public, the internet's very good at accommodating that. And I, you know, for the record, I don't really, I think the explosion of online pornography was probably ultimately a good thing, because it was like a release valve for a very prim society that was pretending it wasn't interested in these things.
I mean, to be honest with you, in fact, many, many people see it that way. It is a relief valve, and in others see it the same way as one does a martini. If one has a normal or a genetic propensity to just be able to have a martini and relax, it is a good thing. And if one is an alcoholic, a martini is a bad thing. So the internet pornography, you know, mixed with cocaine, mixed with certain personalities, becomes an addiction. And for those who occasionally like to watch it with their girlfriends or wives or by themselves, it becomes something that, you know, may provide some necessary relief. I personally find in my practice that it creates more problems than it solves, because it doesn't teach anything about real love, real intimacy, real penis size, and everything else, so that you get a lot of neurotic people who think that they're horrible lovers because they can't have sex for an hour straight.
You also get a lot of teenage boys who think they're awesome lovers, and, you know, their girlfriends would beg to disagree, because they've learned how to have sex while watching internet porn, right?
Well, I don't know if they've learned to have sex. I think they've learned to have a fantasy of sex. That's my point.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. And that comes down to, are we intelligent tool users, right? And maybe that's what a lot of this conversation comes down to, is how much can we be trusted, right? Those questions about regulation, the question about internet police, it really comes down to, can we be trusted? And the extent to which we are educated about media, about technology, I think that ends up being a marker of how much we can be trusted. If you have an informed citizenry, if you have a literate citizenry, you're much more likely to have a democracy that kind of works half the time, right? So I think if you have a media literate citizenry, if you teach McLuhan and if you teach the history of technology to kids in elementary school and high school kids, they're going to be less naive. They're going to be more sophisticated consumers of these technologies when they grow up.
You know what? I think the obligation to teach the origin of everything is part of the responsibility of both parents and educators. Having said that, everything that we have been taught, if you remember your own, I'm obviously a lot older than you, do we really apply it every day to what drives us to do what we do? The question is that the internet is a powerful driver of emotions. And can it be trusted in the hands of a few? And can it be trusted in a democracy environment? Or can we put the genie back in the box? I don't really know the answers to any of this. I do think it really, there's a lot of open debate. Because right now, it has been is being used for great, great things in saving lives. And it is also being used as the greatest propaganda tool in the world to direct buying habits, spending habits, and to solicit terrorism from all over the world, which for me is a big issue.
You mentioned ISIS earlier, but also look at what's happening in Hong Kong. The citizens of China literally cannot find information online about what's happening in Hong Kong right now. It is a sort of bait and switch scenario with the internet, right? You get a whole country reliant upon certain channels for all of their information, and then you monopolize and control that channel. So in China, they really can say, as far as this 1 billion strong population is concerned, no, nothing's happening in Hong Kong right now. That's a very scary sign.
I'm going to take the opposite position. China has been, during the time of the Cultural Revolution, before you were born, has been an incredibly dangerous country. Nuclear weapons and people with no other reason to live other than, to start a revolution. Now, it is the most capitalist country in the world, where they've created in a short period of time a middle class of 400 million people. Maybe right now they want to limit the amount of information, because democracy happening at too fast of a pace is what we've seen in the Mid East, which is why we have the disaster we have now.
Well, I don't know if I agree about that. I mean, I have to think that almost all the time, transparency of information is key to democracy, and you get a kind of pseudo democracy. If you've literally got a country choosing, or you've got a government choosing who can run for government and who can't, and then silencing anybody who wants to fight against that notion, and then also masking even the argument itself from a billion people, that's nowhere near an enlightenment position.
So, Michael, should the government control information the way they see fit, if it's about crowd management during a viral outbreak?
Well, I mean, that's a very difficult question. And I'm not smart enough to answer it. I suppose if there are national security risks, then you can start to see why that would be a worthwhile thing. But then the question always becomes, who gets to decide what a national security risk is, right?
I guess the people who we hire to represent us, and then to choose those people.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody in that chain of command thinks that they're being an evil person in the moment, right? It becomes almost Hannah Arendt's idea of the banality of evil. That to get back to the internet, I don't for a moment think that the people running Google or Facebook or Twitter believe that they are in an evil way controlling the masses. I think they're all just doing what they think is the best thing for their company, and they even do believe they are making the world a better place.
But Michael, how is that different, though? How is that different from the Rockefellers, from the Carnegies, from those who were the titans of industry, who really controlled everything, okay, and everyone else had to follow those rules? How is it any different?
For me, I think it's different because of the way it plays out in my daily life. I mean, I wasn't there in the days of the Rockefellers, but I think there was probably, in your lived experience, you know, in the way that you have breakfast, in the way you have that 1 hour of cool down time before you go to bed, these little moments of absence, of solitude, where, like Michel de Montaigne said, it was that little back shop at the back of your brain, right, where you could reserve a place to develop that rich interior life. And I don't think the Rockefellers, as controlling as they may have been, ever got into that little back shop for the everyday person. For myself, personally, living today, I feel like that part of me where I develop my rich interior life is always, there's always something banging on the gate, trying to take me away from my own solitude. I really have to make a decision now every time I leave the house to not take the cell phone with me. I have to make a decision. Here's the thing. When I wake up in the morning, I used to think, what will I do with my day? Now I think, what did I miss? And I jump on my phone, right? I think that's true for really most of us now.
Michael, you wrote a great book. I want everyone to buy it. And I truly, truly thank you for spending the time with me.
Thank you for a great conversation.
Terrific. I'll talk to you soon, Mike.
All right. Cheers.
I want once again to thank Michael Harris for coming on to our show. Pick up a copy of his book, The End of Absence, on Amazon.com. And while you're doing that, visit his website at www.theendofabsence.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem, there is a solution. I am your problem solver. Check out our other episodes on gluckradio.com. Keep listening. Keep telling your friends. Keep sending in your feedback. Till next time.